Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and a very warm welcome to another episode of the Liz Earle Wellbeing Show. I'm Liz Earle and I'm talking to leading experts and familiar faces from the world of wellbeing to bring you wellness wisdom you can trust. Now, those of you that tuned in last week will know that we have taken a break in our normal publishing schedule to bring you the most relevant wellness wisdom for navigating the current COVID-19 crisis. Now, we here are currently self-isolating, and to keep everyone safe, we are recording this show down the line, so please do excuse any minor connection glitches. Now, last week, the amazing Pilates instructor Natalie Clough shared how a simple indoor Pilates routine can help to keep our bodies fighting fit and resilient to injury. And this week, I've had the pleasure of chatting to clinical psychologist Dr. Jemima Fitzgerald, who shared her top tips for those of us trying our best to stay mentally resilient too. Well, for Jemima, resilience is the key to a happy and fulfilling life. And we can't avoid hardship and adversity in life, but with a bit of resilience, we can cope, we can survive and hopefully thrive, grow and flourish while we weather these ups and downs. So do join me on Instagram after the show to share your thoughts on everything discussed in this episode. We would love to hear from you. But without further ado, let's hear from Dr. Jemima. So Jemima, thank you so much for finding time to talk to us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you. How are you finding lockdown, first of all?
Well, it's a very interesting time, isn't it? I mean, we've never known times like this. And I think lockdown has been so such a quick change. We're having to adjust. I'm personally having to adjust very quickly. You know, my work has adjusted. Family life has adjusted. You know, so my husband's a prison officer, so he works in prisons every day. So he goes in and comes home, and in a way, his life, although it's got more scary, is normal.
Yes.
And but for me, my you know, adult daughter living at home, where life has really changed, and it's amazing how many things you miss that I thought, gosh, I took that for granted.
Yes.
Before. The normal things of life, but also how quickly it's possible to adapt and how quickly you find other ways to connect with people. And that whole feeling, and I know it's a cliche of we're all in this together, you know, and I'm you know, we talk about resilience, but that feeling of there's something very shared about this experience has really hit home to me. And how much we need each other. So
absolutely.
Yeah. But I'm doing well.
Good. Well, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head, isn't there, about being adaptable and about how we can realise our capacity in a way for change. and testing our own resilience, because it's been an extraordinary time. How many of us, as a society as a whole, been plunged into this extraordinary situation and seeing how well, on the whole, people are coping? Is that because we are naturally resilient, do you think? I mean, are we resilient creatures?
Oh, I think we're incredibly resilient creatures. I think human beings, you know, we've survived such, as a race, we've survived atrocities, we've survived all sorts of things, and we adapt, we're resilient. Some people are more resilient than others. But for me, you know, resilience is something that can be learnt and sort of changes as we go through life. Sometimes we feel more resilient than others. And, you know, when I'm talking about resilience, I'm talking about that ability to cope when things are tough, when you're going through a hard time, when you're up against it, especially when you're in a situation where you feel out of control and you're stuck and you're trapped. All of that stuff is really hard, but we can learn how to become more resilient. And I'm very keen that we look at resilience through a lens of compassion. So it's you know, some people have real misconceptions about the word resilience and think it's about toughening up or getting on with it, or being a bit stronger, or being positive all the time. And it really isn't that. I mean, obviously, sometimes we do need a bit of grit. Sometimes we do need to sort of try and look at the positives. Of course, that's part of it. But, you know, you talked about adapting. And there's this Japanese proverb I absolutely love that says, the bamboo that bends is stronger than the oak that resists.
Oh, I like that.
I love it. And there's something about being able to bend, being flexible, being able to change and adapt as we go through, especially times like this, but in life in general, that really is the key, I think, to resilience, or one of the keys anyway.
Well, we'll get into some specifics in a moment, but I'm interested to know how you first became interested in the whole subject of resilience in the beginning.
Wow. Well, so I'm a clinical psychologist, but I didn't become a clinical psychologist till I was in my, well, I started training in my mid-30s. So I had a whole other life before that. And I had always been fascinated with psychology, but just as a layperson, I was very interested in the subject. And I went through some really tough times in my life. You know, as a child, I don't mind speaking about this, as a child, there was a lot of abuse that I was subjected to as a child. And then I was in a violent relationship for a long time as an adult.
Yes.
And so I know I'd been through some tough times, and I certainly didn't feel resilient. I felt really, really low in mood. I had very low self-esteem. So I understand what it feels like to just feel hopeless. Mm. And I certainly did feel hopeless, but I wanted to understand what it is that helps people to adapt. I wanted to know it for myself, but I also wanted to learn it for other people, because I'm, you know, as we all have, I've met so many people in my life where they've been through some really difficult times, you know, to greater or lesser degrees, but we've all had stuff. And I wanted to know what the keys are. How do some people just seem to kind of get through it and even thrive and flourish, and other people don't? So what are the differences? What are the keys? So that was my real interest. And when I trained to be a clinical psychologist, my doctoral research was around resilience. How do we develop it? What are the processes involved? And very much that it's a dynamic process. It's not something you're born with. You either have or you haven't. It's not binary. It's something that we can develop.
Well, that's really encouraging. That's really good to know. I'm interested in your journey. Did you decide to do clinical psychology from your own experience? Did you see that as a way out, or did you think, I'm through that now, how can I give back to others?
A little bit of both. So when I was a teenager, I wanted to become a clinical psychologist, or a psychologist. Nobody know about clinical psychology, but a psychologist. And then I found out that you had to study for 6 years, and I thought, well, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to do that. So I didn't. But then having gone through some really difficult life experiences, I really felt and I got out of this marriage that was absolutely awful. Mm. And having got out and survived it, I thought, do you know what? I've got a second chance of life. I felt like I'd come out of prison, and suddenly I had this whole new opportunity to start living again. And I thought, right, what would I really love to do? I need to have a career. I need to earn some money, and I need to have a purpose in my life. I need to find meaning so that all those, that 16 years of my life in my marriage isn't wasted.
That's a really great way of looking at it, isn't it? That you use that for good. You turn it around, you turn it on its head and get a real positive benefit from it.
100%. And that is actually what I now know, I didn't know at the time, is fundamental in resilience, is the idea that no pain is ever wasted. So we all go through tough times in life. And if we come out of it, sometimes during it, we say, what the hell, what's the purpose of this? But if having gone through it, we can reflect and say, what did that teach me? What did I learn? Not that we would ever have chosen it, because none of us would ever have chosen adversity or tough times or any of that stuff, but having had it happen to us, what can it teach me? What can I learn from it? How can I grow as a result? So it doesn't just become another painful experience in my life, but it becomes transforming. And now I know that that is so key, because then we have a sense of meaning, which is one of the building blocks in resilience, is having meaning in our life. Not that we know the meaning of life, because that's a very big question, but we have meaning in our life. And there was an amazing psychiatrist actually in 1946 called Viktor Frankl. He wrote a book, and he was actually a survivor in a concentration camp. Not quite what we're going through right now, but there was something about being trapped and locked in, and a really difficult times. And he observed two types of prisoners in this concentration camp. They were all suffering tremendously and going through awful, tragic, terrible times. The one type was the people who just gave up and felt utterly hopeless, angry, couldn't cope, and many of them developed mental health difficulties, obviously, if they were lucky enough to survive. And then there was a second group of people, and they were the people who were able to say, I'm going to use this. This experience I'm going to have a sense of purpose and meaning. So for him, he decided he was going to one day go out and give lectures and write a book about his experiences, and that got him through it. For other people, they stored up what little scraps of food they could to give to other people that they thought were struggling more than themselves. And it was those people somehow that seemed to cope the best and didn't come out with post-traumatic stress disorder and didn't come out. So they, and mostly reported feeling a sense of personal growth, having gone through the worst atrocities. So I do think having a sense of meaning, whatever we've gone through in life, small things, big things, whatever, is just vital.
So that really is the key then, if you want to set apart a resilient individual from someone who is really struggling, it is having that sense, or that ability to see that there is a point to the pain, that there is a purpose within it that can be put to good use afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it can sound quite trite, because it's not that we, people go through tragedy, and it's not that I'm saying that's a good thing, because of course it's not a good thing. But whatever it is, if we are able to turn towards it and say, do you know what? Thank God that's behind me. What can I learn from it? What did I learn about myself through it? What did I learn about life, the world, all of that stuff, then that's going to help. I mean, it's not the only building. There's three main sort of aspects, I guess, to finding resilience, building resilience, but that's definitely one of them.
Okay, well, let's come on to those. But then would you say that people who've had a really happy-go-lucky, carefree childhood and upbringing are perhaps going to be less resilient when they're older, if tragedy or downfall befalls them? Are they going to be less able to cope potentially?
Well, it's a balance. I mean, I think there are many people that I meet as a psychologist now, people that might come to me, say in their 40s and 50s for therapy, and something awful has happened to them. And they say to me, do you know what? I've never had anything bad happen to me in my life. My life has been pretty much perfect up until then. Now, and yes, they do seem to struggle an awful lot, because they haven't built up that sense of, how do I recover? How do I know that bad times happen and then they pass and I will get through it?
Yes.
Having said that, people who've had a really, really difficult childhood, so we have these things called adverse childhood experiences. And there's 10 of them, really, that are recognised. Several of them are related to abuse. Some are about witnessing domestic abuse. Some are about having a parent who is incarcerated. So there's 10. And if they've had a lot of them, then they tend to struggle more in life. So it's kind of that good enough parenting, actually, that is the ideal. And I certainly, I mean, there's 10, they call them ACEs, adverse childhood experiences categories. I would say I had 9 of the 10. So that's pretty high.
So you were pretty resilient by the time you were, you know, a young adult.
Yeah, I was a survivor, no question. I was definitely a survivor. But having said that, we are all survivors by the very nature that we're still alive.
That's true.
And we're still here.
That's positive.
It is positive. I was definitely a survivor. What I had learned that was wrong through that, in a sense, is that I'd survived. I knew for a fact I was strong. I remember thinking, I'm strong. I'm a strong person. I can cope with anything. And the way that had got twisted in my own mind, which happens to a lot of people, was, yes, I'm strong, so I can cope with anything, and therefore I will and I should put up with anything. So I was very good at saying, I'm going to get through this day, I can do another day, I'm strong and I'm tough. But I was awful at saying, but you deserve better, Jemima. So I hadn't developed the other part of resilience, which is about compassion and self-compassion. I'd never developed that. And that is absolutely critical in terms of well-being.
Oh, my goodness. That is so insightful. I absolutely love that because, of course, yes, I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it, when you explain it like that, that we come through bad experiences, we're toughened by it. They say what doesn't break you makes you stronger. And, you know, you can cope with a lot of things. And then you, I guess, automatically feel, a lot of us, I'm sure, are feeling that right now. I can cope with this. I can do this. But, you know, where is the self-love? Where is the self-compassion? It almost feels slightly self-indulgent to be saying, yes, but what about me?
Yes. And lots of people say that. And I think it's also quite a British thing, you know, that, oh, compassion, it's a bit fluffy. It's a bit self-indulgent. It's but actually it's crucial. And, you know, we are obviously at the moment with the coronavirus situation, we are socially distanced. We need to look after ourselves because we don't know how long this is going to go on for. But when I was talking about meaning, what's really crucial in this situation is that we can learn something from this. And one of the things might be about, do you know what, I'm going to change some things about the way I live my life that are more compassionate to myself and then to others. And actually, if you know, I think before we're all in a rush to get back to normal. I can't, you know, I'm looking forward to being able to go to a restaurant again and see my friends. I can't wait. Mm. But I'm also reviewing my life and thinking, well, what parts aren't I in a rush to get back to? Are there things I need to change? And you know, I think it's a good time to reevaluate our life and our lifestyles and how can we be healthier? How can we have more of a compassionate attitude towards ourselves? How can I learn something through this time? All of that stuff.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of us will come out of this the other side with a slightly different view on our lives and the way we live and what we see as important and what we value and what we miss more than anything else. It was in a very different way. I was asked to do a sponsored fast for a charity a year or so ago, and it was only a week, 7 days, so it wasn't very long. And I mean I could eat sensibly, but I could only drink water. I was only allowed to drink water, plain water, not with any flavorings, no coffee, no tea, obviously no alcohol, nothing. And I thought, oh, this will be quite easy, I know I can just do this, it's straightforward. And what I missed more than anything, more than, you know, an alcoholic drink or something special, I just missed a cup of tea. You know, it was that simple thing. And after, you know, when I got to the end of day 7, when I was able to make myself a cup of tea, it tasted like the best thing ever. And I think that first time when we are able to connect with people again and hug our friends and just go for a simple thing, like a group walk in a park, actually next to each other and not you know, two metres apart. You know, what a pleasure that will be. And my, you know, my son, who's 10, said, oh, I miss school so much. You know, I miss my friends. And those days of having to kick him out of the door and say, come on, hurry up, you know. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of people out there. But coming back to resilience, you talked about self-compassion and being kind to ourselves. How do we put that into practice? How do we kind of speak more kindly to ourselves?
Good question. So we know that with our bodies, our minds, our brains, they're all connected. You know, we can't really separate all of these things out. We are, you know, and I very much like to take a holistic approach to mental well-being. And when we are in that, you know, when we're feeling under threat, when we feel physically threatened, we have a fight or flight response, and that's activated by our sympathetic nervous system. So our sympathetic nervous system in our bodies activates us to be active and to get out of a threatening situation. So if you were being chased down the street, your sympathetic nervous system would kick in, and your blood pressure would rise, your digestive system would shut down because you don't need to be having a drink or a snack at that time. No. You don't need saliva in your mouth. That's why you get a dry mouth. The arteries around your heart would constrict. You would have, you know, more cortisol, more adrenaline in your body. So there'd be a physical response. And that's great. And what your brain would be doing was it would be focusing on purely on the threat. So all your brain would be thinking about was being chased and how you're going to survive that chase. The problem is that that fight or flight response is also activated by psychological threat. So if somebody gives you a dirty look at work, or if somebody is being intimidating to you, then we will equally get that. But worse than that is it's also activated by our own inner voice.
What?
So if you're somebody... Yes.
No.
Yes. Honestly, I was the world's worst at this. And I only realized this when I was training as a psychologist, how much I put myself down. It was a constant thing. And sometimes we can think it's a motivating factor, you know, like, well, if I'm too nice to myself, I'll never get anything done. But if we're constantly saying, you stupid woman, you're an idiot, nobody like that, or I can't believe you just said that. If we talk, that also activates our sympathetic nervous system, which isn't very sympathetic. Wow. And it really gets us. It's really bad for our health, really bad for our mind. And it means that then we are also focusing on threat all the time, which is why often when we go home from work, we'll think about the one thing that went wrong, or the, you know, whatever we've been doing that day, the one thing that we said that was a bit stupid that we thought, rather than all the great things. We all do it. We all do it. So what we need to do is to get our bodies out of that sympathetic nervous system and kick in with our parasympathetic nervous system, which is the other system. And that's a very grounding system. And we do that by developing, one of the ways we do that is by developing a kinder internal voice. And for me, when I realized how often I put myself down, I thought, gosh, I can't just switch this. I can't just change it. I've had 37 years or something of doing it. So it's going to take a long time to you know, rewire my brain. So I had to do it very deliberately. And it sounds stupid. It sounds crazy. But I would talk to myself sometimes out loud. It's actually, the science says when you speak to yourself out loud, it has more of an impact on your nervous system than when
really?
You speak to yourself
in
your
head. So do we really need to stand in front of a mirror and go, you are just amazing? Because I don't know if I could do that.
I can honestly say I don't do that.
What do we have to say?
I think I would just feel like an idiot. So for me, it depends how critical you are of yourself.
Right? Yes.
You're a very successful woman, and maybe you don't put yourself down a lot.
Well, I don't know. I do. There's always something wrong. Oh, my goodness. I mess up, you know, all the time, every day.
Yeah. So we all do it. So I started with baby steps. So for me, it was about if I made myself a cup of tea and I made a nice cup of tea, I would actually say, sometimes out loud, mostly in my head, well done, Jemima. That was a good cup of tea. And what the science says is if you actually use your name, rather than just say, well done, you made a cup of tea. Yeah, your name, your brain interprets it as if somebody else has just said it to you.
No, so I've never heard that before. That's fascinating.
Isn't it fascinating? So if you say it out loud, even better, because then your brain interprets it as if somebody really had, I think your listening part of your brain and your speaking part of your brain are both engaged. But if you can't say it out loud, so in the car is a great time to give yourself a good positive chat about yourself.
Yes.
But if you can't say it out loud, at the moment we might not be doing a lot of driving, so you can say it in your head, like, well done, Jemima. You made a good cup of tea. Or, well done, Jemima. That was nice that you just waved at the neighbor there. I know it can sound really crazy, but that's about retraining.
That is fascinating. So, for example, I did my hair this morning and I was doing it really quickly, but I tried using these new hair tongs and I did quite a good job. So I was quite pleased. And so, when I looked in the mirror, I could have said, hey, great job, Liz. Hair looks great. And I mean, that feels a bit daft to be saying that, but actually I guess it would have given me a bit of a boost and perhaps put a bit of a positive spin on the what's been, you know, a fairly difficult day, to be honest.
And it, has a, it does have a physical effect on you. So not only then will you, it's like someone's just given you a compliment because you've used your own, but it's more likely then to get you out of that feeling of being under threat. And sometimes we get so used to anxiety and threat, we get so used to just an undercurrent, if you like, of that yes. feeling in our bodies that we don't even notice it's there. So it's important to very consciously start to develop a kind way of speaking to ourselves. And honestly, I did this for a long time and I don't have to consciously do it now. I sometimes laugh at myself because I notice myself complimenting myself and I think, oh, you're funny. Like, honestly, I do it to myself all the time. I'm not going around saying I'm great. I promise you, I'm not saying that. But I notice when I do a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's not big-headed. That's sensible and it's kind. And I try to talk to myself like a nice parent would to their child or, mm-hmm. you know, or to how I would talk to my own best friends or yes. my own children. And if I can give it out to other people, why shouldn't I give it out to myself?
Yeah. Do you think that there's a big sort of male-female thing here? Because I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking actually a lot of guys I know, they will, you know, they will kind of give themselves a pat on the back, perhaps more than we do as women.
Yeah, yeah. I can't always generalise, can you? Men and women are, but there are some differences. And often men don't have this tendency to feel they need to be modest all the time. You know, in business, we see it in the world of work that often it can feel like for a woman to say, yeah, I'm really good at that, that feels really uncomfortable. Whereas yes. for a lot of men, they've got no problem saying that.
No, you're not so right.
Yeah. It can feel a bit odd, strange, very uncomfortable. But it's good for our well-being and it kicks that parasympathetic nervous system in, which makes you feel grounded, safe. It reduces your blood pressure. It makes you feel, it helps your brain to think clearly. So if you're in a bit of a situation where you need to think clearly about something, one of the ways is to talk to yourself in a kinder way. And also, it's not just about giving yourself compliments. It's about understanding why you did something. So for me, the hardest time is when you have actually done something wrong. You know, say if you shouted at your children, and so you do feel guilty. So it's not a case of, well done, Jemima, you were a great mum yes. today. You know, I can't really say that, but I can say, do you know what, Jemima, you're under a lot of stress at the moment. You need to go and say sorry to your kids because that wasn't right. Guilt's a, you know, we have guilt for a reason. It's to motivate us to put things right, but not shame, I'm a bad mother, I'm a bad person. But rather, do you know what? I'm probably like most other parents. I get cross sometimes. Yes. I need to go and say sorry, but I'm going to have compassion with myself. There's a reason.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I love that. I love that difference between guilt and shame. I think that's really powerful.
Shame is such a blockage, I think, to building our resilience. So when we feel shame, we separate ourselves out from people. Because, you know, right now, you know, we one of the third building block, if you like, of resilience is connection. So we all need to connect with each other as human beings. We're social beings. And, you know, I've done research that shows that when we feel socially excluded from other people, we experience a significant drop in our body temperatures.
Gosh.
So It's really interesting. So people are literally left out in the cold if they are.
Wow, that's a real expression, isn't it? Left out in the cold.
Yeah,
That's amazing.
Yeah. I know. So yes, that's fascinating. So so we need to connect. Right now we're social distancing. I like to think of it as physical distancing,
yes.
Not social distancing.
No.
Because actually we're physically apart, we can still connect.
Very much so.
And you're doing it on your, Instagram lives. You're finding ways to connect.
I'm connecting more than ever. It's extraordinary, actually. And it's opening up a whole new range of possibilities. And I've connected with people internationally that I haven't connected with before, haven't thought to reach out in this way. So I think there are definitely some positives. I know you've written in the magazine recently about the importance of boundaries.
Yeah.
How does that come into play here? And why is that so important? And I think you've mentioned that women can particularly struggle here.
Yeah, so often women are brought up to be nice, to be people pleasers. And people pleasing is rooted often in shame. You know, there are lots of different aspects to shame. One is, you know, we can feel shame about physical appearance, body image. We can feel shame about getting older. We can feel shame about not being a good enough parent or our physical or mental health. All sorts of things that we can feel shame about. And so, you know, in terms of how we can connect with each other, it's really important that we find ways to still connect. I've lost my train of thought now.
Don't worry.
Yeah, it happens, isn't it? But I'm gonna be kind to myself and come back to it.
Yes.
in a crowded room, we've all had that feeling of being a lot amongst lots of people, but still feeling lonely. So it's not about how many people are around us. It's about feeling that I've got something in common with you. I've got some way of connecting. And these can be tiny little ways of connecting, but also big ways. And so finding ways of connecting, I would say is the most really, really big part of resilience. At the moment, we're experiencing in this lockdown situation a real sense of collective grief, I would say, because, you know, there's a lot of grief associated with this. Some people have lost their jobs, lost their plans. You know, my oldest son was due to get married in a couple of weeks, and that can't happen now. So there's lots of things that have changed. People have lost a lot of things, and a lot of uncertainty. So really coming for resilience, knowing that, you know, it's a cliche, but we are all in this together. Other people are feeling this too, and we are going to get through it. This will pass, and there are going to be things that we learn from it. But when we've grown up feeling bad about ourselves, or when we've felt shame, we tend to pull in evidence that confirms how we feel and screen out evidence that disconfirms that. If that makes sense, we kind of have an internal working model of who we are, how we relate to other people in the world, and so every time somebody ignores us or is a bit offhand, it kind of fits. That's like more evidence that fits with I'm not.
We just accept it and say, that was, of course, I'm not worthy of anything else, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is really quite staggering, isn't it? Now, I know that you wrote a particularly brilliant piece for us online for the website about sharing tips for staying well during this particular time that we have of social distancing and self-isolation for those people who have perhaps been asked to stay at home for an extended period of time, or who have to because they are directly affected by the virus. Could you share some of those now for those who perhaps haven't seen the online article?
So one of them was about having some structure in your day. So looking at it through the lens of compassion as well, it's not, you know, don't set yourself too high standards, but I do think getting up in the morning at a reasonable time and getting dressed is good. You know, it's very tempting to just sit around in our pajamas all day, and I
say that to my teenagers every morning. So I should be quoting you.
There you go. So having some structure is good. Doesn't mean you can't have downtime, but you know, having a definite start to your day, but also having a definite end. And I've really noticed that working from home, it's very easy for it to leak into, you know, your work, to leak into, you know, your evening. And so, having a beginning and an end is very important. But, you know, coming back to the whole people pleasing thing, often if we have some shame around parts of our life, then it's hard to say no, because what we're trying to do is to overcompensate for this feeling of I'm a bad person. Or I'm a terrible mother, so therefore I've got to overcompensate. Mm. Or I'm a terrible employee, so therefore I need to work harder than everybody else to prove myself. So there's that. If that's the narrative that's driving your life, you know, really watch out for boundaries. Really watch out for beginnings and ends of your day. And I like to have a little bit of a ritual at the end of my day. Obviously, that's changed. Before, it was the drive home from work and listening mm-hmm. to a podcast or listening to some music and just sort of switching off. But now I don't do that. But I'll definitely have a cup of tea. I'll, you know, put some rubbish on the TV, something that's just, yeah,
something. Yeah.
I'm done for the day now.
We've discovered our lovely Pilates instructor that sometimes comes into the Wellbeing Studios. She does an online Instagram free Pilates class at 6 o'clock. And that's just a great time because you can, you know, literally that's the time when we just get out a yoga mat, push the sofas back, and whoever's around does a bit of Pilates. And it does, A, it's good to be physical, I think, to work out some of the stress of the day. But it is that punctuation point, isn't it? It's saying, right, that's it now. That's my boundary. Now I'm going to move on.
Definitely. So that's important. It's really important that we find ways to look after ourselves. So coming back to that self-compassion, you know, we talked about coming sort of kickstarting that parasympathetic nervous system, as well as talking kindly to ourselves, also finding other ways that kickstart that system. So it's the rest and digest system, basically just slowing everything down. So deep breathing, really, really important. If you can find ways to just take in some nice, slow, deep breaths, gets the oxygen flowing to the brain to help us think clearer. Or mindfulness or meditation, whatever works for you. Mm. Doing some exercise that just gets the blood pumping around your body, gets the endorphins going in your brain. And that exercise can be, you know, really aerobic, or it could be going for a walk. It can be, you know, star jumps in your living room, whatever it is, but trying to do that. Also finding ways to connect with other people. And that could be, you know, I'm using Zoom and Skype and FaceTime more than I ever have before, or phone calls. But, you know, for some people in my family, just sending them a card if they're not really into that kind of thing. Can be really helpful. Finding ways to connect and touch base and not assume that people are okay, you know, just look for ways to just be kind. And I think that's one of the things that's going to really come out of this. I loved it when we all came out of our front doors and clapped at the NHS. I saw people in my street I have never met before, and it was such a feeling of unity. It really moved me, actually, that feeling of, do you know what, we all need each other. And you know, I think that feeling right now in social distancing of, we do need each other. And I hope that that's something we take from this, that, you know, even when we go to the supermarket, I've never been more aware that if I take two packets of toilet roll, that means someone else can't have a packet of toilet roll. Or, you know, whether everything we buy has an effect on somebody else. So that real sense of community, I think, has never been so important. And it's really good. So, yeah, so looking after our brains, our bodies. I mean, there's even things, all our senses need to be looked after. So I'm all for, like, I love lighting candles, any aromatherapy, or, you know, there's some research about different smells and what they do to our mood. So citrusy smells are very good for our mood. In terms of lifting mood, lavender is very good for calming. Most people know that. But also looking at the colour green. So if we look at the colour green for 20 minutes, it's shown to reduce cortisol, that's the stress hormone in our body, and boost mood. So getting outside, and we know we need a bit more vitamin D. I mean, that's going to be crucial. But getting outside and being able to look at the colour green, if we're lucky enough to be able to get to if we have a garden, if we can look at some trees, if we can walk to a park, anything, that the colour green is we've got a lot to learn from nature at the moment, I think, to help us through lockdown.
Fantastic. There's some great tips. There really are. And I think it's nice to end on a positive, the fact that, as you say, these little things about being more socially aware, more socially connected, we will come through this, and we do have the resilience, we do have the capacity. We can be kind to ourselves, kind to each other.
And I think, you know, just to remember that we all feel these feelings, you know, to greater or lesser degrees. We're all feeling a bit anxious, some people very anxious. And anxiety is about fear of the future. You know, I've whenever we're scared about something, it's always about what might happen next. You know, even people that I've met that have been attacked, they talk about, do you know what, when I asked them, what was the thought that was going through your head while you were being mugged or attacked? It was always, what were they going to do next? It's always about the future. So if we can bring ourselves back to the present, just take some deep breaths and say, right now, I'm okay. I'm safe.
Yes.
I can do this. And talk to yourself in that calming, kind, compassionate way, then that will really help to build your resilience.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Jemima. It's lovely to chat to you. And I hope that once this has passed, we can actually meet up in real life, because it would be nice to give you a proper hug rather than just a virtual one. But thank you for being with us today.
I'd love that. Thank you, Liz. I really loved it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that is it for today's episode. As always, you'll find all the links and resources mentioned on today's show over on lizellewellbeing.com. There you can sign up for my free weekly newsletter, which is jam-packed with wellbeing wisdom and delicious quarantine recipes using pretty much any pantry staples. Well, a huge thanks to all of you who've left such lovely reviews for the team and for me. It really does help others to find the show, so thank you. And until the next time, go well. Bye-bye. The Liz Earle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Liz Earle, with production by Amaryllis Earle and Harry Trevithick at Heart Dialogue. With thanks to my producer, Ellie Smith, and the guest booker, Millie de la Morinière.